Hi, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. It's such a pleasure having you join me today for another exploration into topics that are quite relevant to our lives and, of course, to the lives of our friends and family, colleagues. So, as always, I'm looking forward to a wonderful conversation. This is all about empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decision regarding your health and well-being. And I always like to remind people who may be listening for the first time that I have a wonderful website called whatwomenmustknow.com. If you opt in there, you will be able to receive many special reports. You get access to radio shows such as this and ongoing information that I may be presenting in programs. And also my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, is a great place to go to get further education. I'm always posting great tips and recipes and articles. So that's what I'm all about, is providing you with the quality information, education that will really guide you in this world. We need to get educated with truthful information. So here you have some more options. And today we are continuing our conversations to empower you with truthful information so you can really know what's going on. And today we're going to be talking about what you must know about the use and the misdiagnosing of psychiatric drugs with Dr. Alan Francis. So this is a wonderful interview. I'm really thrilled that we have time with Dr. Alan Francis. Let me just share a little bit about him. He is a medical doctor who is currently professor emeritus and former chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University School of Medicine. He has published op-eds for the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times. Dr. Francis has recently appeared on PBS's NewsHour, on NPR, numerous regional radio stations, and is in four documentaries. He has also been called on to comment for articles in Time, Wired, the New York Times, Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, as well as The Economist, ABC News, MSNBC, and many others. He was the chairperson of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, for those that don't know what DSM is, task force, and part of the leadership group for DSM-3 and DSM-3 Revised. He is the author of Saving Normal, An Insider's Revolt Against Out-of-Control Psychiatric Diagnosis, MSM-5, Big Pharma, and the Medicalization of Ordinary Life. It's a really important topic, and I'm so pleased that you are able to be with us, Dr. Francis, today.
Well, I agree. It's an important topic, and I'm very pleased that you'll be spreading the message.
Well, it is a big message, and I just want to start off by sharing my experience, my research, where I really plugged into what's going on here and why this is such a powerful message. I focus on women's health and women's hormones, and I don't know, maybe it was 12, 15 years ago, I started to see information come across that there was an that Prozac was going going to go generic. So in order to stop that from occurring, which of course meant the loss of much money, new diagnostic term was created called PMDD for women who had premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which was in the DSM. So it was considered a time when women would become rather emotional and have angry outbursts before their menstrual cycles. And to treat this new condition, they created a new drug. Well, actually, it wasn't a new drug. It was a version of Prozac, which they named Seraphim, made it of a pretty purple pill, and then stopped Prozac from going generic. And so a new condition was created that now women going through menstrual imbalances, or the old term PMS, would now be treated with powerful antidepressant drugs, which I have a big grudge against. So so that's, you know, and by the way, it was all to prevent Prozac from going generic. Are you must be aware of that whole.
Yeah, just one small correction. We didn't include it in DSM-4. It's now included in DSM-5. But it's an excellent illustration of the power of drug companies and where their interest lies. The drug companies have been remarkably unable to come up with better drugs. The research efforts have been directed mostly towards Me Too drugs that would make money and be sure bets. They've been unable to come up with anything more powerful than drugs we had 60 years ago. Slightly different side effects, but not more effective. On the other hand, they're brilliant, absolutely brilliant at making money. And they spend twice as much on marketing and controlling the government than on research. And most of the research they do is stuff like this, you know, nonsense stuff of trying to figure out ways to extend patent life so they can charge outrageous amounts of money for the pills rather than doing anything that would really help people. So I think one of the major messages that I hope people will hear is don't trust drug company commercials. Don't believe the misinformation that they pour out constantly in the media. That their job is to make you buy pills, not necessarily to help you.
So first question I have of you, I mean, you were so involved in this whole thing. You're a prestigious psychiatrist. You have this, you know, position with DSM. What happened that got you to become quite a rebel and a heretic in your profession?
Well, I'm not sure I'm that much of a heretic. I think lots of people agree with me. Most people with common sense would agree with me. But, yeah, there was a concern we had in doing DSM-4. We started in the late 80s, and we were already worried about the problem of diagnostic exuberance and diagnostic inflation. And so in preparing DSM-4, we were remarkably conservative and had very strict rules against changing things that would, in a way that would expand the boundaries of psychiatry. Strict literature reviews, data analyses, field trials. And when we finished, we were pretty happy. We thought we had, you know, contained the monster and that there wouldn't be any greater expansion of psychiatric diagnosis. We were dead wrong. It turned out that 4 years after DSM-4 was published, the drug companies got an unprecedented right, which is only in the United States and New Zealand, to advertise directly to consumers. And they just went to town. And anything that could be misused in the DSM-4, blown up out of all proportion, made into a fake epidemic, was made into a fake epidemic. And particularly, we were struck by what happened with ADD, that it tripled. The rates have tripled, at least tripled since DSM-4. We now have 20% of teenage boys diagnosed as having ADD, 20% of teenage boys, 10% of them are on medication. And amongst all kids, 4 to 17, 11% are diagnosed and 6% are on medication. Now, ADD is a real problem. And maybe, you know, 1 or 2% of the population who need to be taking medicine for it, but not 6%, not 20% of teenage boys. There have been similar explosions of childhood and adult bipolar disorder, and also an explosion of Asperger's and autism. And so what I came to realize was that even though we were self-satisfied, we had really missed the boat. We'd failed to predict and prevent what became fake epidemics with really, I think, dire consequences. And then about 5 years ago, I became aware of the fact, at a cocktail party, that my friends working on DSM-5 were going to really open the floodgates, that their instructions had been the opposite of the instructions we had given 20 years before, to be really careful. Their instructions were to be really creative. And so lots of new diagnoses were being kicked around, and I realized that I would have lots of them. That, you know, I definitely have minor neurocognitive disorder with my forgetting of old age. I definitely have binge eating disorder. When my wife died, my grief would have qualified under the new definitions for major depressive disorder. My grandkids probably would qualify for temper dysregulation disorder. A whole bunch of things that were being introduced that I thought were really dangerous, and that's why I felt it was important to warn the public about the risks of overdiagnosis and the risks of overmedication.
So we are being medicalized and pathologized for the vicissitudes of life.
Yeah, I think that the human condition is filled with sadness, worries, stresses, difficulties in facing up to problems. That's part of life. And what the drug companies realized, going back about 25 years, they realized that the really sick psychiatric patients, the ones who really needed their medicine, that would constitute a population of only about 5%. If you could expand the boundaries and have a quarter of the population think of themselves as psychiatric patients, your profits would increase by fivefold. And that's exactly what's happened. We now have 20% of our people in the U.S. taking a psychiatric drug on a regular basis. One in five people is convinced that they need a psychiatric drug. Now, the 5% definitely need medicine. And there may be another 5% who probably need medicine. I'm not saying that medicine is not useful. I've used it my whole career. I think it's valuable, sometimes life-saving. On the other hand, the misuse, the excessive use of medication, causes more harm than good for the people who take the drugs they don't need. And the other problem is that we spend a fortune on drugs for the worried well and the mildly ill, and we're terribly neglecting the really sick, that 5%. We now have 1 million psychiatric patients in mental hospitals, in prisons. 1 million psychiatric patients in prisons, and hundreds of thousands homeless. And the reason for this is we provide, amongst all the developed countries in the world, probably the worst community care and the least adequate housing for psychiatric patients. So they get arrested for nuisance crimes that easily could have been avoided had they accessed the treatment, a decent place to live. And the sheriffs have learned that it doesn't make sense bringing them to the hospital because there's no psychiatric treatment available for them. They bring them to jail first, and in jail they deteriorate and often get into solitary. 200,000 prisoners are raped a year. A lot of those are mental patients. So my, you know, sort of despair is that we're spending money, a lot of money, on mental health care, but in all the wrong places. And the people who really need it are shamefully neglected. The people who don't need it are shamefully overtreated. And we need to reassess and apply our resources where they belong.
So when this DSM-5 came out, which really sounded like it was in conjunction with the objectives of the pharmaceutical industry, they had all this massive advertising for every possible condition and drug to cure it. And then you have the general practitioners, because I think you were saying that, the primary care doctors are part of the problem, because they're prescribing 80% of psychotropic drugs. Is that because they are interested in the financial benefit of that? Are they getting kickbacks for doing it? Or is it because they have been brainwashed, or a little bit of both?
Well, the whole system's been brainwashed. So that if a patient has seen an ad, and it's almost possible not to see ads these days, that have someone that looked more or less like you, but the ad is suggesting that person has a mental disorder, that mental disorders are often missed, easy to diagnose, always due to a chemical imbalance, easily treatable by a pill. If the patient comes in asking for a pill, it's hard to get them out of the office without giving them a pill. And it turns out that the doctors are 20 times more likely to prescribe a pill if the patient has seen a commercial and asked for it. The doctors themselves are subjected to a very intense sales campaign conducted by the most beautiful salespeople you can imagine. The men and women are as handsome and beautiful as Hollywood waiters. They've been selected for their capacity to get a foot in the door of a busy doctor's office. Mm-hmm. And they have a compelling story about how this new medicine is the latest and best, and that the doctor will be doing his patients a favor, and the drug company will do the patients a favor by giving the doctor free samples on his shelf. Now, primary care physicians have 7 minutes with a patient, on average. They don't have the time, usually don't have the interest, and very rarely have the skill to make an accurate diagnosis. And no one in the world can do it in 7 minutes, including me. So there's a rush on their part to diagnosis. They won't get paid for the visit from the insurance company unless they make a diagnosis for it. There's a rush to get the patient out of the office and happy. And so the easiest thing in the world to do is to make a diagnosis, give the patient the free sample, they leave the office feeling they've gotten something out of the visit, and everyone's happy, except in the long run, you can't make a diagnosis that's going to help a person in 7 minutes. And that moment of diagnosis can be vitally important in a person's life. An accurate diagnosis can make all the difference. It can save a person's life. It can materially enhance it if it's done well, if it's accurate. Patient no longer feels uniquely damned. My condition's understood. I have an answer, and this is going to help. An inaccurate diagnosis can really haunt a person for life. Lead to treatment that's unnecessary and will have side effects. Often the treatments have no benefit, but they have very definite side effects. You don't know when you get better, whether you got better because of time, your natural resilience, a change in the situation, support from your family, or the pill you were given in 7 minutes. Most often, at least 4 out of 5 times, it's going to be the natural resilience and the tincture of time, not the medication. But you won't know that. And if you decide it's the medicine that helped you, you'll be very reluctant to stop it. A lot of these medicines have profound withdrawal symptoms attached to them, so if you try to stop it, you'll get worse than you were at the beginning, and then you think, the medicine's saving me. And so people stay on medicine for very long periods of time that they never needed. And if we did a more accurate diagnosis at the front, if we realized that this is at least as important a moment as buying a house or a car, if we put the same attention into diagnosis and care in prescribing pills as we do for other life decisions, we have a lot fewer people taking medicine they don't need.
So interesting. It's like the game is really rigged, and everyone knows it's really rigged, from the doctors who get seduced by the sales staff to the system that doesn't allow time to really sit and assess what's going on with the patient, nor look at their lifestyle or diet and other solutions that may be as effective, perhaps even more. So the whole system is broken, really. Every aspect of it is broken in the model that exists today.
I think, and it's not just in psychiatry, it's in all medicine. That overdiagnosis and overtreatment plagues all of American medicine. We spend almost twice as much on medical care as other countries, and we get lousy results. And it's for the same reason, that we overtreat people who don't need it, undertreat people that do. Now, the people who set up the guidelines, meanwhile, I think there are some bad apples where financial conflict of interest is a major factor. But by and large, most of the people who do things that I think are terrible mistakes do it with pure hearts, but they have an intellectual conflict of interest. Experts in any area tend to overvalue their area and want to expand it. So I think that by and large, it's a system where most people mean well. I don't think the commercial folks at the drug industry mean that well, but I think most of the practitioners mean well, but are badly misinformed and make decisions of convenience and decisions that fit in with their preconceived pet notions, but may not be best for patients, especially when they're applied by primary care doctors.
Well, that's the other point I was going to make. So here you have people coming in with either real psychiatric conditions or contrived conditions that are put into that slot and are being assessed by primary care doctors who don't necessarily have a clue what's going on because it's not their area of expertise.
Yep, and so, an informed consumer is the best protection against the commercialization of medicine and of ordinary life. And I think no one amongst your listeners should ever accept a diagnosis made quickly and by someone who doesn't have expertise. And I would always recommend against ever accepting free samples. There are always lots of strings attached to free samples, and they won't be free forever. And very often it's a poor choice that was made for purposes of convenience to get you out of the office.
So can you just tell us a few of the contrived conditions that are now in that DSM-5 book that defines and describes psychiatric or conditions that are worthy of psychiatric treatment?
Yeah, some of the situations will seem completely ludicrous to anyone with common sense. And the reason they get in is because experts in an area often don't have common sense. So but probably the suggestion, the change in DSM-5 that caused the greatest uproar amongst people and the press, medical journals, was the change in how grief is considered when it's considered to be a medical disorder. In DSM-5, you lose the love of your life, the most important person in your life, and if 2 weeks later you're sad, you have loss of interest, reduced appetite, difficulty sleeping and less energy, the doctor can give you the diagnosis of major depressive disorder. And the drug companies are already making this part of their sales pitch, that doctors should be looking for depression amongst their patients who are recently bereaved. But this is complete nonsense. We're mammals, and one of the things that characterizes mammals is we attach. We form love relationships. It's perfectly normal for mammals to grieve, not just human mammals, but also dolphins and elephants, and not just mammals, actually, parakeets, parrots. It is part of life, part of the price of love, that when you lose someone you care a lot about, that you're going to feel sad, have less interest, less appetite, trouble sleeping, and loss of energy. That's not a medical disorder. That's the human condition. And when you make it a medical disorder, you, first of all, insult the dignity of the loss, making it seem like it's an illness, not a completely understandable reaction to loss. You substitute superficial and dumb medical rituals for the time-honored ways of dealing with the painful moment of loss. And you subject people to the risks of medications that won't help and may cause harm and certainly will have side effects. So that's probably the suggestion that seemed the dumbest and that made it through. The second most controversial suggestion has to do with how to deal with people who are, and it's often women, who have physical symptoms, pain, nausea, bowel symptoms, joint symptoms. They're physical symptoms where you can't explain them after doing the medical tests. And such people have been condemned often in the past to the doctor saying something like, it's all in your head, it's all psychological, which is terribly unsatisfying and often will miss the fact that there's an underlying medical condition that hasn't been understood, or that the symptoms may be due to a clear-cut psychiatric problem like panic disorder or depression, which can have many somatic symptoms. So what DSM-5 has done is open up this field for psychological misinterpretation by introducing a new disorder called somatic symptom disorder. Hmm. And to get this, all you have to have is one symptom that the doctor feels is in excess of what it should be. In the trials, field trials that have been done already on this, it turns out that 1 in 6 patients with disorders like migraine or irritable bowel or chronic pain would get this diagnosis. That 1 in 4 patients with those would. 1 in 6 patients with cancer would get it. Mm-hmm. And 7% of the general population would get it. So that wildly expanded boundaries for this concept of somatic symptom disorder. And this outrages people who have symptoms that haven't been well explained, because they worry understandably that they'll get short shrift, it's all in your head, and won't get a medical word.
And what drug would they be diagnosed with?
Say again?
What drug would they be given?
What diagnosis should they be given? That's a great question.
Effexor, okay.
Well, that's a great question. What diagnosis should we do in situations where we don't understand what's going on is one of the crucial questions in medicine. And I think the answer is don't diagnose until you have a good diagnosis. But if there's uncertainty in the presentation, it's much better to recognize the uncertainty than to jump to a wrong answer.
Okay, so they would be put on antidepressants.
Say again?
That diagnosis you just described with the somatic conditions, those people would be put on an antidepressant, Effexor.
Well, they might or they might not. I mean, I think that there's no sort of rule that once you get a psychiatric diagnosis that you will be put on medication, but all too often that is the case. It would be much better for people who have unexplained symptoms to be given counseling on how to deal with them.
Right.
And on how to deal with the uncertainty of having the symptoms, rather than medication. But in the real world, such counseling is usually unavailable, and the reflex of most doctors is to prescribe a pill.
What about shyness?
Well, this is something that's been in the manual before, and it wasn't made worse by DSM-5, but it was too loose before. And it's a case of we're experts doing what might be right for them and at the time, come up with a diagnosis that turns out to be easily misused and exploited by the pharmaceutical companies. So that some people have social anxiety that's absolutely incapacitating, and that prevents them from entering into the workplace. It prevents interpersonal relationships. They just are terrified of social interactions in a way that can be very, very debilitating to their life and enormously distressing. It was with these people in mind that the diagnosis of social anxiety was introduced in the 1980s, and it made sense for them. But what happened was, in the cheapening of diagnosis, the drug companies were able to convince people that everyday shyness was a mental disorder, that everyday shyness was social anxiety disorder, and that they had a magic pill for shyness that would be effective. And so the antidepressants expanded their territory by incorporating what's an average expectable variation in human personality, and some people are just going to be more shy than others, and making that into a mental disorder and something that they had a magic pill for.
You know, we have to take a break, but I just want to make one quick comment. When I've investigated the many of the side effects of antidepressants, the most common ones that come up first off the rank would be side effects, mind you, depression, anxiety, and insomnia. So go figure, right?
Yeah, I think the point is that the harms of medications are never adequately accounted for in harm-benefit, risk-benefit analyses. That there's always a focus on the benefits and an exaggeration of the benefits, never a consideration of the harms. If someone has a severe depression, they need medicine. And in fact, we're neglecting people with severe depression who need medicine. Only a third of them get it. We're over-medicating people who don't need it, under-medicating those who do.
Okay, this is a good place to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this really profound and important conversation with Dr. Alan Francis, who has written quite an important book called Saving Normal, An Insider's Revolt Against Out-of-Control Psychiatric Diagnosis, the DSM-5, Big Pharma, and the Medicalization of Ordinary Life. So stay tuned. Really important for all of us to listen to this conversation. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and you're listening to What Women Must Know. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. You are listening to What Women Must Know with Dr. Cheryl Selman here. And my guest today is Dr. Alan Francis, who is currently Professor Emeritus and former Chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University School of Medicine. He is also the author of Saving Normal, An Insider's Revolt Against Out-of-Control Psychiatric Diagnosis, DSM-5, Big Pharma, and the Medicalization of Ordinary Life. So, Dr. Francis, what got me really interested in this whole area was my own personal journey, which included a time in my life where I went through a time of anxiety, depression. It was in my early 40s. There were a lot of pressures on me. There were a lot of things going on. So I would wake up with these anxiety attacks every night around 3 or 4 a.m. Now, if I had gone to my primary care practitioner, I know for sure I would have been offered, probably some sort of Xanax or, benzodiazepine drug. But instead, I started to investigate what was going on, and I discovered that I had severely exhausted adrenal glands. I had a hypothyroid condition, Hashimoto's. I was gluten intolerant. I was eating too much sugar. And I started to make all these changes in my diet and my lifestyle, as well as healing these underlying root cause issues, which actually resolved all those conditions, including my anxiety. And that was a profound transformation for me in understanding how so many of these psychiatric mental conditions are really symptoms. They're symptoms of being out of balance, of being malnourished, being compromised in some way or other, which if we could support the body in getting back in balance and lifestyle factors, we would resolve these conditions. So do you want to comment about that?
Well, first of all, congratulations to you and to your, being able to have the strength and resilience to do all that was necessary to get yourself better. Yeah, I think that we have to sort of be very clear that there are many people who have problems that won't be solved in the way that you were able to solve yours. Who has severe, clear-cut, classic psychiatric conditions that require psychiatric treatment. And that for those people, it's absolutely essential that we provide them with the care they need, currently not getting. And I would estimate that 5 to 10% of the population.
Right.
About 15% of the population are at the boundary between having mild problems and being worried well, and or having medical conditions that may account for what seem to be psychiatric symptoms. And that's where careful diagnosis and caution comes in. And intervening psychiatrically should happen only after there's been a period of watchful waiting, a careful medical evaluation, a careful psychiatric evaluation, because a lot of people have somatic symptoms, body symptoms, that come from psychiatric disorders. So people with panic disorder can have a racing heart, dizziness, they can have all sorts of flushing and tremors, and often they go from doctor to doctor to doctor before the psychiatric diagnosis of panic disorder is made. Once that's made, it's obvious what to do, and they tend to get better. So I'm not saying that we should diminish our concern about psychiatric problems, because they're often present, often easily treated, once understood, and if there's adequate funding for the treatment. But at the same time, we shouldn't go overboard and assume that every problem of everyday life or every medical problem has a psychiatric basis. We need to be more selective, and that requires time and often watchful waiting. I've been doing this for 40 years, and very often I can't make a diagnosis in one session or two or three or four. It requires knowing someone over time to see how things evolve, to get the medical evaluation, to see what resources they have that can help the situation, to try to reduce the stress in their life and change life circumstance, bring in supports. Psychotherapy is enormously helpful and terribly underfunded because there's no industry backing up advertising for it. Psychotherapists are mom-and-pop operations competing against pharmaceutical companies that spend tens of billions of dollars trying to convince people that those solutions are the best. Exercise is one of the very best things for everything in life, psychological, social, and physical. But there's no industry out there promoting exercise in the way there's an industry promoting drugs. So I think what we have to do is tame the pharmaceutical companies, educate people that the model of everything is a chemical brain imbalance and a pill is a solution to all the problems, but that model is not correct, and find the kind of resourcefulness that you showed to other answers when those answers are more appropriate.
So I have a couple of other questions, and let me start with the question that revolves around from this overprescribing of meds, some of the serious side effects. Or withdrawal effects. Can you comment on some of those so people can be alerted to those risks and dangers?
Yeah, sure. I think you mentioned the drug Xanax. Xanax is the worst drug in the world. It probably never should have been approved. It's been enormously popular. It's like taking a shot of alcohol in pill form. It's been enormously popular. The effective dose is very close to the addicting dose, and so many people become addicted to it. Very hard to stop once addicted to Xanax, even if it was completely useless in terms of the real problem. If you stop it, the symptoms are so much worse than you ever had before that you feel that, oh, I must take this because it's helping me. I think that most of Xanax now is prescribed by primary care doctors. 90% of the prescriptions are prescribed by primary care doctors, and it's still a very, very popular drug. No one should be taking it. Except for very, very specific indications, but you can't get off it easily. You have to have a doctor involved. The withdrawal symptoms can be a whole range of things that go from severe anxiety and insomnia, but worst of all, even seizures. So it has to be done very, very slowly under medical supervision. The antidepressants can have all sorts of rebound effects, including agitation, anxiety, insomnia, and a return of depressive symptoms that may be more related to withdrawal than real depression. So, again, you're much better off ever stopping a medicine, doing it slowly and under medical supervision. No one should come away from this program and feel, oh, I should stop my medicine, because it's likely to make you feel much worse than you did before.
And that's such an important point to emphasize here for anyone who is on a psychiatric medication. They really need guidance how to withdraw safely. Otherwise, like you said, the rebound effect can be worse. So that leads me to the next question. Are primary care practitioners adequately trained in how to guide their patients to successfully withdraw off of these medications?
Some are, some aren't. There's a tremendous variability. Primary care docs, we should have more of them. I don't mean to insult them. They're the bulwark of American medicine, and we would be a much happier, healthier country and have a better handle over the cost of medicine if they did much more of the care and specialists did less. But it is true that under the current circumstances, the rush and the pressure they are to rotate patients out of the office as quickly as possible, to have huge panels of patients so they don't know anyone very well, to have very little time for training, that it's hit or miss. Some will be terrific and some won't. That's one of the reasons why patients have to be very well informed themselves. You have to know a lot about your condition, about the medicine you're taking, and how to interact with doctors. Always ask tons of questions. You should always have at least one, two, or three questions for every time you see a doctor. And if you can't get common sense answers, you need to get a second opinion.
Right. So, you know, it's, it's really, at this place in time, we have to be responsible. We have to do our research. We have to know how to ask the questions. I always like to tell my patients, it's not enough to ask the questions. You have to have enough knowledge to evaluate the answers. So,
yeah, and you have an audience that is very interested in kids. Parents need to protect kids from over-treatment. I said before that we are 6% of our kids on stimulant medication. We don't know for ADHD. We don't really know what the long-term effect that of these medications on the brain, on the behavior of the kids will be. This has been studied. It does turn out that academic performance is not enhanced in the long run. So that the idea that these are miracle pills and your kids are going to get to Harvard if you take them doesn't work that way. It may provide temporary slowing down in the short run, but in the long run, they can provide more side effects and harms than benefits. And the real problem here is fundamentally that we're under-supporting our schools and over-supporting our drug companies. When we spend $10 billion a year on meds that identify kids as being sick when they may not be and focus the attention on them, why aren't we spending that money or some of that money on the size of the classes, offering more gym periods? Law schools have cut out their gym periods. Be much better handling of active kids to let them be active and to give them, you know, a chance to blow off steam than to be giving them a pill. And there's an amazing study. I think parents need to know this study because it really knocks your socks off. It's done in several countries. The best predictor of attention deficit disorder is your birthday. If you're the youngest kid in the class, you're almost twice as likely as the oldest kid in the class to get the diagnosis.
Why is that? Why?
If you just miss the cut, because young kids tend to be more active, less mature.
So that just their maturity level.
Yeah, we're turning immaturity into a disease.
Well, another
treating
one.
It with a pill.
Yeah. What about this trend to put very young children on antidepressants?
Well, actually, it's been a trend to put very young children on stimulants. 10,000 kids in America now under the age of 2. 10,000 toddlers are on stimulant drugs for ADHD. 4% of teenagers are on antidepressants. And there's been a wild overusage of antipsychotics for all sorts of behavior problems. Wow. Without the awareness or the cautious appreciation of the fact that these antipsychotics can cause tremendous weight gain in kids. We already have a remarkable epidemic of obesity in kids. Mm-hmm. These medicines promote enormous weight gains with the risk of diabetes and heart disease, may actually shorten life expectancy. When the medication's needed, we need them, and we should be doing it. But we shouldn't be taking kids who have conduct problems, doping them up, when so many medical risks will follow from it.
Which leads me to the next question I want to ask you. We talked about some of the side effects from various medications like antidepressants and minor tranquilizers, but what about the ongoing alteration of biochemistry that can lead to other health problems or other chronic illnesses from those medications. Can you address that?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, I mean, Prozac, for instance, can affect the thyroid function, can be increased risk of breast cancer. Some drugs can increase the risk of insulin resistance and lead to more diabetes, those kinds of things.
Yeah, it's clear that we underestimate the immediate harms and the long-term risks and focus too much on the short-term efficacy.
Right.
It's really hard to do a reasonable risk-harm-benefit analysis because there's often way too little information about the risks and harms. And sometimes that's because there hasn't been systematic gathering of that information. Sometimes because the drug companies actually suppress information about the harms. Very often it's because it takes time to have all the harms show themselves. I think that the answer is really clear. You use the medicine with respect and caution. You definitely need it. I'm absolutely against people say, oh, we should never use medication, because I've used them and I realize how necessary they are for many people. But you have to have a pretty clear-cut reason for doing it. You have to take the time to see whether people will get better on their own or with other interventions. You have to try counseling before medication for mild to moderate problems. If we did that, we wouldn't have 20% of our population on medication, or maybe 7, 10%, and they might really need it. But we've really blown up the bubble, and unless we contain the drug companies, unless we change the policies of the insurance companies, unless we inform the public in the way that you are today, and increasingly, the good news is that the medical journals, the newspapers, the media, and even the professional societies are coming on board realizing that things have gotten out of hand. My hope is that even though this is a David versus Goliath battle, and you usually want to bet on Goliath, sometimes David wins, especially Mike being on his side, with the righteousness that he brings to the battle. And with the tobacco industry 25 years ago, Big Tobacco ruled Washington just as Big Pharma does now. But they were burnt out by people who had relatively little budget, but a lot of good knowledge on their side. And my hope is that the drug companies have gotten so outrageous in their behavior that there'll be a rebound phenomenon and that gradually they will be brought under more reasonable control.
Well, I think you have to hold that vision because I'm sure, first of all, there is a way. There's always a way to reverse trends. And even though it seems like it's almost impossible to put the genie back in the bottle, but it isn't. And there are people like yourself. There are so many other organizations, practitioners, government hopefully is looking into this. I mean, I am sure that we can recreate the way that psychiatry should be practiced. And by the way, do you have any comments or do you have any experience with orthomolecular psychiatry?
Yeah, I think it's one. Psychiatry's been filled with fads and magic ways of doing things, and I think that's probably one of them.
Because that's based on nutrition. It's based on addressing nutritional deficiencies that can impact brain chemistry. Do you think that's kind of a fad?
I think so. I think the best way of recalibrating brain chemistry for most people is probably exercise. I'd go on exercise more than diet.
So you've seen the results of exercise. You've obviously recommend it to everybody, everyone.
If we had a country that exercised more and took less medication, we'd be a healthier and happier place.
So what type of exercise do you see is most effective?
I think it's getting people to do whatever they'll do.
Right.
So I don't think there's one type of exercise. I think it's anything anyone will do every day, building it into people's lives every day. And the most amazing thing with anxiety and depression is how hard it is to get people started. But once they start, they won't stop, and it helps tremendously.
Right.
It doesn't help severe depression. It doesn't help psychosis. Doesn't help the severe psychiatric problems, they will need medication. But for the everyday problems of life, it's amazing to me over the years how much people have benefited from exercise programs.
So what do you see as the way psychiatry should be practiced? And do you see it growing? Do you see that approach increasing in practitioners?
Well, actually, it's been decreasing. The psychiatrists have been given a smaller and smaller role in psychiatry. The drugs are being mostly prescribed by primary care doctors. Psychiatrists are doing much less psychotherapy than they once did. And I think psychotherapy is a very important way of dealing with many of the problems patients present with. I think a better psychiatry would be one that was more rounded, bio, psycho, and social. And instead, the psychological and social aspects that are so important in people's lives and problems, that these are being downgraded largely under the influence of the drug companies, but also because there's been such an amazing advance in the neuroscience, basic neuroscience of understanding the brain and the genetics of understanding how we develop, that there's this feeling like we're about to really understand mental illness. Well, we've had that feeling for about 40 years. And the truth of the matter is that the brain is the most complicated thing in the known universe. There are as many neurons in the brain, a little 3-pound thing that controls our thoughts and behaviors and emotions. That 3-pound thing is 100 million, I'm sorry, 100 billion different neurons, as many stars as in the galaxy. And each of them is connected to 1,000 others. And the secrets of the brain are very elusive. We have understood a great deal about brain functioning. We have amazing tools, but it hasn't helped a single patient yet. And my guess is that going into the future, with all of the research dollars, it will be a very slow process. We're not going to have sudden breakthroughs in understanding schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or autism. All of these are going to be very heterogeneous conditions with lots of different causes. It's like breast cancer, where we have an understanding of maybe 3 or 4 or 5% of breast cancer through all the studies we've done. If the breast is the simplest organ in the body, the brain is most complicated. We have a long way to go for breast cancer. We have a much longer way to go for understanding psychiatric disorders. So I think we shouldn't overestimate the biological and ignore the common sense psychological and social factors that are so important in promoting mental illness and also in preventing it and treating it.
So as we kind of wrap up our conversation, come to the end of our interview, what would you say to people? What would be the key steps you think people need to follow to make sure that they are not rapidly diagnosed, or if they have been diagnosed or have been treated, what do they need to do to help reevaluate their treatment and their diagnosis even? And one last thing we never talked about, the stigma of a diagnosis.
Be cautious. Don't presume that a label will always be accurate. Don't accept quick diagnoses. Don't accept free samples. Don't start treatment until you've sought it over. If you have marked severe problems, you need treatment right away. You should be getting it. If you have milder and especially recent problems, it's much more likely that it will get better on your own or with counseling. Don't go to a medication solution. And stigma is a huge issue. I think we've reduced the stigma of having mild psychiatric disorders because 20% of the people are taking medications for psychiatric symptoms. 25% would qualify for a diagnosis. It's less of a big deal now because so many people have been included in the big tent of psychiatric disorder. But we've increased the stigma of having a severe disorder, and we're consigning these patients to absolute hell in prisons and on the street. They are the most stigmatized population. Recently wrote a blog that said, is this the worst time ever to have a severe mental disorder? And I think in the U.S. right now it is. We're doing a terrible job with the severely ill. But for the rest of your audience, the severely ill aren't listening. For your audience, the main thing is be a very informed consumer. If the glove doesn't fit, don't wear it. Don't jump into reckless treatments for yourself, and protect your kids from medications that, if they're not necessary, may do much more harm than good.
And what is the best website for people to go to learn more?
Well, I can't speak to the world at large, but I publish blogs in Huffington Post, Psychology Today, Psych Times about once a week or so, and I keep up with things and help other people keep up with things, Twittering with Alan Francis, at Alan Francis MD.
Okay, so you don't have a website of your own right now? Okay,
I'm a techno idiot. I can't do fancy things like that. But I did learn how to Twitter. Twitter's wonderful.
Well, you did really good getting into this call today, so congratulations on that.
Okay.
So, and people can find your book online on Amazon and wherever they sell books. So, Dr. Alan Francis, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much for the important work you're doing. It's really been a pleasure and honor to have you on the show today.
It's the other way around. I'm grateful to you. I think that only through people becoming informed will this mess be solved. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, you have a great day. And for everyone listening, check out Dr. Francis' book. It's really an interesting read, actually. It's quite readable, quite enjoyable. It's called Saving Normal, An Insider's Revolt Against Out-of-Control Psychiatric Diagnosis, DSM-5, Big Pharma, and the Medicalization of Ordinary Life. And to all of you listening, thank you for joining me today for another exploration to topics that really make a difference. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.